exclusively on Paramount Plus. Get ready.
Vamanos!
To explore like never before.
Swiper knows. Swiping!
Oh, man!
Swing into action.
We need your help.
Woohoo!
Yay!
With a girl who put adventure on the map.
I don't think I can do it, Dora.
I'll protect you, Boots. Together, we got this.
Todos juntos!
Yay!
Dora, the brand new series. Stream with your family now, exclusively on Paramount Plus.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Want to get smarter about investing? Then tune into the Capital Ideas podcast from Capital Group, home of American Funds Distributors, Inc., one of the world's leading asset managers. Learn from portfolio managers with decades of experience by listening to the Capital Ideas podcast today.
Welcome to New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Joel Cherney. Today, I will be speaking with Christian B. Long about his book, The Imaginary Geography of Hollywood Cinema, 1960 to 2000. The book was published in 2017 by Intellect. In his book, Christian examines American films of the late 20th century and how they are often built around specific locations, both real and imagined. We talk about Burt Reynolds and his use of the South for locales, how Disney decided where to set its live-action films, as well as the role of the suburbs in movies. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Christian Long. Hi, Christian.
Thanks. Hi. Thanks for having me.
So we're here to discuss your book, The Imaginary Geography of Hollywood Cinema, 1960 to 2000. But before we go more in depth with the book, I always like to know a little bit more about the author. And so if you could give me a little bit of your background, maybe educational or where you are now in your career, and we can start to talk a little bit also about your writing experience.
Okay, I'm from a little working class suburb outside of Chicago called Carpentersville, Illinois, and I'm a college dropout. I failed out of the University of Iowa, and after doing that, I worked in a multiplex cinema for 10 years, and I also worked in a public library for 4 or 5 years, and kind of the main job that I saved up all my money to go back to school, I worked at a place called Northwest Structural Steel, where I was a welder, fitter, helper, pretty much did everything in the steel plant because I was the newest guy there. And I also ended up working as a draftsman, and I even cleaned up after the boss's dog when it would poop on the floor in the office. But after working in steel for 4 or 5 years, one summer I almost lost my left thumb when 1,000 pounds fell on my hand, and I'm left-handed, so that would have been a drag. And then after I healed from that, we were moving a beam just not very far, and the clip that was holding the beam broke, and that fell on top of me on my leg, and I decided maybe I should go back to school.
Sounds like you were getting a hint.
Yes. But when you fail out of university, other universities don't want to take you, so I had a little bit of a hard time going back to school. I ended up going to a junior college for a semester, Harper College in Palatine, Illinois. And then eventually I went to Illinois State University where I did my BA. I discovered that I didn't like teaching high school kids when I did my student teaching. So I figured maybe I would try teaching adults. So I went to graduate school. So I moved to New Hampshire where I went to the University of New Hampshire and did my MA. And there I met my future wife, and she was a year ahead of me at UNH. And she got accepted to Vanderbilt to do her PhD. So I decided I would apply at Vanderbilt as well. And somehow I was also accepted. So I ended up doing my PhD at Vanderbilt, which is probably the last place I would have expected to go. Finishing my PhD, my wife got offered a job at the University of Canterbury in Christchurch, New Zealand. So we packed up the dogs and cats and all our stuff, and we moved. and we had a great time there. Unfortunately, the earthquakes kind of made all of my work disappear, and it became very difficult to live there. Our house was deemed unsafe to live in, although we still lived there for 6 or 7 months after they said that. And my wife ended up finding a job at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, in Australia. So now I live in Australia. I don't have an academic job. I have a boring office job. I work in a graduate school at UQ. Although right now, when I say that, I'm currently a visiting professor at the University of Vienna. I'm teaching a class basically on my book. And I don't know if they know that I actually don't have an academic position, and I'm not saying anything until we're done. So that's at the moment. For the next couple months, I'm in Vienna, and then I'll go back to Australia, and I'll go back to my office job, which I think is very preferable to working in academia, to tell you the truth.
Well, we're talking about geography, and you just presented an incredible geography of your career, starting in the Midwest, then New England, and then the South, and then Europe and Australia and New Zealand. So you've really have been all over the world.
Now, I was a bit of a late starter because I had never left the central time zone until I was about 26, with some rare exceptions, like to be in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which is actually the eastern time zone. So I was very much a working class kid who, you know, we couldn't afford to go anywhere. So now I feel like I'm really lucky that I go all around the world now. It's weird.
So is there an aspect about your degree, your educational work, your academic work that pointed towards film?
Well, the first class I took, and I was just taking it as a foundations class when I was at Illinois State, was an introduction to film studies class. And one of the movies we watched in it was Hollis Frampton's Nostalgia. And it just blew my mind. And so that was when I got into film studies, that it was something beyond just kind of standard narrative film. And then in the same semester, I took a geography class, again, just a required class. And the professor who taught it, like, had pictures of himself swimming in the Amazon and just doing weird kind of field work type things. And I had grown up reading atlases. And so kind of seeing somebody who I imagined their job was like doing atlas things. But actually, it was much more, he was a human geographer, so there was a much more kind of hands-on human interaction that I found really fascinating. And so those two things kind of followed me through my undergraduate. I didn't do geography as a PhD because, at least in the U.S., I would have had to do quants, and I'm not that great at math. So I just kind of do a poor man's version of geography and kind of spatial thinking, and I hold on to that, the film studies part of it.
Yeah, I always think that my opinion is that anybody who goes to college, if they have the opportunity in their undergrad work to try to take a basic film studies course, because I did the same thing. Of course, when I was going to school, there was no, for my undergrad, there were no VHS, there were no video recordings. We were actually seeing films that were shown on projectors, and it was interesting to get a chance to see a movie that, at the time, you had no chance of seeing any other way. It had to. I still remember the movie that I saw that really hit me was Intolerance, you know, one of the D.W. Griffiths. And of course, I'd never, you know, there'd been no opportunity to see it beforehand. So you're right about how film studies courses can be so interesting to get you someplace that you never thought about as far as movies are concerned, and get a better sense of what's available.
And I think even now, the class I'm teaching right now, it's just the first movie we watched was The Man Who Knew Too Much from 1954. Mm-hmm. And that's basically another world to the students, even though theoretically it's available to them. They're not going to have watched it. And so I do feel like one of the things that film studies can also offer is anybody can go down to the local theater and watch whatever's coming out this week. But I think one thing film studies can do, it brings Intolerance to you, which is a fascinating movie in its own right, but also it gives you something you wouldn't normally get. And I think that's really important.
Plus, nowadays, being able to see, you're right. I mean, we now have access to all these, but it doesn't mean you're actually going to watch them. So you're absolutely right. You have to sometimes get pushed or pushed into the right direction, so to speak. So I can totally agree with you that even nowadays, having access doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to take advantage of it. But it is great. I say this in just about every podcast where I talk about the ability to see films that in the past would have been almost impossible to see. So that's very useful. And so I can see how this helped you in some ways as far as the availability of things. Mm-hmm. So is this your first book, or have you done other kinds of writing already before this?
Well, I have about 20 articles and book chapters that I've done, and I co-edited a collection with a friend from graduate school, Jeff Menny, who's at Oklahoma State now. And actually, the job I had for the first 5 years we lived in Australia, I also did it when we lived in New Zealand and when I was at Vanderbilt. I spent a lot of time actually teaching engineers and scientists how to write. And that's really kind of what I've done to make money as a job, I guess. And that really comes out of working in a steel plant. And it was kind of a joke that the guys on the floor wouldn't talk to the engineers, and so they made me talk to them. And so they would always say, "Christian, tell Kaz that I don't want to do that," and he would just be standing right there. But I think engineers are a really fascinating group of people to teach, because they're a lot easier to teach writing to than arts students, because you just treat it like a machine. And you say, if you change your inputs to do X and Y, you will have a better output, and people will like what you write better. It'll be more easy to understand. So my background in writing is kind of instrumental and kind of technical writing. And it's gotten even more so. I was working with professors and stuff writing up multi-million-dollar grant proposals. That's kind of what I think of as writing. And then what I do is kind of just fun, as far as I'm concerned. I have no promotion writing on what I have to write, so I just write what I want to write.
Well, that's a good thing. It's always good, even if you're writing for a specific purpose. I mean, you know, if you have to write, that you do what you want to write. So it's even better when you can pretty much choose what you want to write about. So what led you to, what brought you to decide that this was a book you wanted to write? I mean, obviously you've mentioned that you had, you know, obviously film, but then also you have the geography part as far as some of your mm-hmm. academic work. So what led you to decide that this was a useful topic, or a useful way to combine the two?
Well, originally, I thought of it as a project that I called it the World Atlas of American Cinema. And I actually wanted to write an atlas. And this was when Google Maps first started up and you could start making your own maps. I said, well, this would be really cool if I could do a literal atlas, maybe go decade by decade and so on. It was a little bit too big of a project. And I also discovered that it was neither fish nor fowl when it came to writing up postdoc applications and stuff like that, because if it's just an atlas, there's no critical component, so that's not really a postdoc. And I would say, no, I want to have critical essays in it as well. And they would say, well, what's the point of the atlas then? And so I ended up narrowing it down, and I just said, well, I don't want to kind of just do my tricks to some movies, but I rather want to say something about movies that I wouldn't expect to. And so that's why I started just mapping where movies take place. I'm really literal minded, that I just accept that the movie says this is Brooklyn, even though it's obvious that Jackie Chan is in Vancouver. And so I said, well, I just want to see, if I take a step back from all of these movies, what do they tell me I need to say about them? And so that's why I think the chapters in the book are a little bit, they seem scattered, but I think that's because I just let what the evidence looked like tell me what to do.
Was there a particular reason you decided to start with 1960, or was it just a matter that you knew you were going to have to limit it some way, shape, or form? Otherwise, it would be impossible to really pull together. So did 1960 particularly, was that important for that to be the starting point?
Yeah, I mean, originally the date was 1927, and I wanted to just handle sound cinema in the 20th century. And when that proved to be too much, I think really it ended up just being a round number that I guess 1967 or 68 might have made more sense, because then we can just talk about the new Hollywood and move forward. But in the end, I thought, well, 1960, it's a round number, and it also gave me access to the Disney live-action movies, and it gave me a little something to play against. There's a 7 or 8 year period where there's some movies that aren't new Hollywood. They're still kind of remnants of the studio system, and it gave me kind of a foil to play against the kind of larger part of the narrative, which is post-new Hollywood.
So when we talk about geography of Hollywood, and of course it's the imaginary geography of Hollywood, right. I think of geography in other mediums, specifically most likely in literature, where it's not unusual for authors, fiction authors, to sometimes create entire worlds or entire cities. Sometimes they take a city that already exists and bend it to their own way. And then, of course, there's some who sort of combine the two. Thinking, for example, of Stephen King, who likes to set most of his stories in Maine, but he creates cities and towns in Maine rather than using actual ones, and then sometimes does use actual ones. So how does what you're trying to talk about when it relates to Hollywood, how does this compare, say, to other forms of with this whole issue of the use of geography in media?
Well, an article that I wrote earlier, and it's in a project that I'm still working on, I talk about it's called Infrastructure After the Zombie Apocalypse. And I think what's interesting about literary representations of locations and kind of geographical information is that that kind of stuff doesn't show up on accident. It's placed there. They actually had to write it. They had to edit it. The editor had to be cool with it, and so on. And so I think it's quite pointed. I think the kind of Lovecraftian Stephen King locations, in terms of the film, I would just say, yeah, this is in small town Maine. It kind of doesn't really matter what town it is. It's not in Portland, so we can just say it's small town Maine. Films, and I say this right in the first, I think, paragraph of the book, is that there's something there. You can't have a movie, I mean, you can, but Hollywood films don't do it, that just takes place floating in space. There's always just something behind this woman who is talking and saying something. And so the kind of literalization that you get of locations and films is in some ways incidental to the narrative and accidental, but I think that's what makes it kind of fun to look at, is that, sure, it's just a lot that they say this is a New York street, but I just say, okay, it's a New York street. What else can we learn from it? Whereas I think literature, and here I guess I show my stripes as someone who does come from literature, I think literature is far more complex and complicated and hard to deal with compared to film.
Well, yeah, the visual aspect all by itself makes that different. In your review, and obviously you said you were thinking, you had originally thought about going back even farther. Mm-hmm. Have you been able to tell where in the film, from study, where do you see the geography, obviously probably always, but I mean, where in your mind did you start to begin to notice this when you were, with films? And obviously it's every film had to have been filmed someplace, as you pointed out, except for, some science fiction films, which are completely done on a sound stage with blue screen, but or green screen. Mm-hmm. But like you say, most films had to be filmed someplace. Did you actually look at some of the, when studios started creating their own sets that were supposed to represent areas? Is that something that caught your attention?
There's a map, and it shows up quite frequently on like film Twitter and people's film Tumblrs. And it's from Paramount, and it has a map of California, and every location in California has a country or a different location given to it. So like Arrowhead Lake stands in for the Alps, and parts of the desert, Mojave could be the Sahara. And so Paramount quite early was already thinking one of the advantages of moving to Hollywood is that there's a huge variety of kind of geographic forms that you can use to expand the locations of where your movies might be set. Certainly you can build a set. It's cheap. It's faster. You have a lot more control. But I also think that there's, and I use the word advisedly, there's a realism to going out there and doing a location shoot that becomes a selling point. And California just offers so much that I think that map really kind of caught my eye as, oh, well, obviously this is planned. And there's all of this within kind of a one-day drive. And so it expands the possibilities for the stories they want to tell so that they can take place elsewhere and they can give a credible vision of the world. I think they still end up being in a fairly limited number of spaces, which is important and interesting in its own right. But that it was clear to the suits that multiple locations can stand in for multiple other locations, and we can use those in interesting ways. Is clear from the second that they've moved back to California.
Of course, we see this nowadays where there are certain cities and areas of the world, particularly North America, that have become, focus, centers for films that tend to be. And we see this exact example of a particular area supposedly filling in for multiple areas, including some areas that are actually real areas, not as opposed to just saying, out in the desert. Instead, we're saying we're in New York City, even though we're not in New York City, and things like that. I mean, I can think of Vancouver, for example, has become, or for many years now. I remember, The X-Files was filmed in Vancouver, and part of the reason they did it was because what I read was they could use Vancouver just happened to be an area where you could create different climates and areas that could sort of fill in as needed.
Right. There's that. And then there's also, depending on the strength of the Canadian dollar, you get a lot more bang for your buck, which is not to be sniffed at. The story I always remember is that Toronto tried to get someone to work for them so that they could be more credibly Chicago-like, because people were using Toronto to stand in for Chicago so much. And I think that's kind of, that's a fun game that you can, when you see your hometown being another hometown, it's fascinating. The Matthew McConaughey, Kate Hudson movie, Fool's Gold, was filmed in Brisbane, a large part of it, including like the office where my boss worked in, and the boss that made me quit the job that was at QUT. And so it's weird to see the Chancellery Building playing City Hall of Key West, or the old Government House of Queensland standing in as a museum in Key West. And so I think it's those moments where if you know it, the movie means something else entirely, but if you just take the movie at its word, it's just, a nice looking sandstone building that, sure, that's Key West. Okay. And it colors our geographical imagination of the world in ways that I would hope people will continue to press on.
Yeah, there's a number of examples. I grew up and lived most of my life in Cleveland, Ohio. And over the last 20 years or so, maybe a little longer now, Cleveland has had some reasonably well-known movies that have done filming there. But then, of course, there's the opposite. The best example I can think of is the baseball movie Major League, which is supposed to be about the Cleveland Indians, and yet most of it was the ballpark and everything else was filmed in Milwaukee. And so you do see bits and pieces of, second unit footage in Cleveland, but most of it's in Milwaukee, including the ballpark, which they didn't even change the radio station logo on the clock in the ballpark.
Yeah, it's got WPMJ on it, and that's right. How you listen to Packer games on that.
So it's pretty obvious that it's not Cleveland, but then there's the opposite where, like you say, they film in one area that's supposed to represent another area, and I, a couple of examples of that too, that like you say, I think it's a matter. My favorite of all time was Air Force One, in which the opening scene where they're going to grab this terrorist, they end up landing on Severance Hall in Cleveland, Ohio, which is the classical music hall for the Cleveland Orchestra. And like you say, no one would notice unless you happen to be from Cleveland. But when I saw it, and I immediately recognized it, it was one of those things is, okay, this is supposed to be Russia, but it's in Cleveland, Ohio. So I can see
a couple of great Cleveland movies, though. I mean, The Fortune Cookie. You can't beat a Jack Lemmon, Walter Matthau movie. That's a Cleveland movie. And American Splendor.
Right.
Both of which I think kind of use the I would say the American imagination of the vibe of Cleveland really well.
Right.
And I think that's one thing that that it's like, and I say this is my mother's family name is Joe Lombardo, so I come by my Italian American culture, I guess, honestly. How much of the kind of fetishization of kind of mafia mythos is legit and how much of it is learned from movies? And so we kind of know about particular cities and the kind of people who live there. And I think movies kind of teach us in a particular way. And actually, it's one of the chapters in the book about medium-sized cities. I try and gesture at that. But there's much more going on. When you say, like, the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra, that's one of those things that it's kind of simultaneously funny, but it's obviously true. There's a symphony orchestra, but we don't associate Cleveland with that. And part of that blame falls on kind of media productions that just kind of say, post-industrial, the river lit on fire, the end.
Right. So let's talk a little bit more in depth of the book now. I think we've pretty well laid the groundwork. You've got an introduction, which is pretty long, you know, it's pretty long all by itself, where is Hollywood cinema? But then you get into particular types of films and particular areas. Most of the book, obviously, you tend to go with the United States, although your final chapter does get outside of this area. But let's start right at the beginning where you talk about Burt Reynolds films and their importance to how the South was suddenly being viewed in the 1970s, where suddenly the South was becoming more important economically, not even related specifically to films. But so now suddenly his films in particular started to take advantage of more interest in the South. How do you see Burt Reynolds' films being so important as far as this is concerned?
Well, I think this chapter is the best example of the method that I use. I have no particular feelings about Burt Reynolds other than like I had seen the Cannonball Run movies and Smoking the Bandit and stuff like that. But when I made maps of all the hits and then I started making other maps of are they set now or are they set in the past, I started seeing that there was a real kind of cultural imaginary that just said the U.S. South is the past. And the U.S. South, especially when you leave, you realize this, the U.S. South is associated with, like, that's where racism is. And it's much more complicated than that. So I did live in Nashville for 5 years, which is what I used to think of as very Southern, but it is not, according to all the other people who live there. And I started to see that there's a more complex picture, and there's a group of kind of really good histories that kind of I bring in throughout the chapter, like Bruce Schulman and Cobb, that talk about that the South, you know, contains multitudes. And I think what makes Burt Reynolds really interesting is that his movies are the only movies that are set in the contemporary South. Like the only ones that were big hits and making money that lots of people would have seen. And so the story that I use in there is Paul Young, who was my dissertation supervisor, talks about how in 1977 he was really disappointed that Star Wars wasn't playing at his movie theater in Iowa because Smokey and the Bandit was playing. And then you look at the numbers and you say, of course Smokey and the Bandit was playing. It was making tons of money and Burt Reynolds was a big, big star. That's what you want in your movie theater. And so I looking at all of that, I just said, well, why was Burt Reynolds a star? There's a lot of kind of charming, handsome, strapping guys making movies. And it seemed to me an underappreciated aspect of his appeal was actually where his movies were set. That if you're reading the news every day and you're dealing with kind of the deindustrialization of the Northeast and the Midwest, and you're hearing about the South being important, and then you look in the newspaper and you see that there's a movie set there, that's just that little extra push that might make you want to go see it and kind of take an interest in it. And so you can watch him throughout more than a decade. His movies are almost uniformly set in the South. He gets out of there. Maybe he does one for me and then one for them. But they're set throughout the South in a way that is very purposeful. And so we get not the kind of exaggerated accents, but just kind of normal people with Southern accents. And we get a different sense or a different vibe, a different kind of culture in play. And I don't think it's the only reason, but I think Burt Reynolds being Southern at that time, when other movie stars were not, and other movie stars were in fact kind of decidedly not Southern. You look at like Robert Redford or Al Pacino, very kind of WASPy and a New York ethnic, I guess we could say, that Burt Reynolds just offered something different and engaging, and he happened to be funny enough and charming enough to kind of follow up on that.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Of course, they weren't all of his Southern movies weren't necessarily comedies, though. We can think of Deliverance as the most obvious one, but you're right. I mean, the like you say, Smoking the Bandit and all these other films that take place in that area. Now, did they tend to be the South in general, or were there areas that were particularly featured? I mean, I know a lot of them were road films, do we have representations of specific areas?
Well, so like the Smoking the Bandit movies, they range across the South, and they have the kind of traditional establishing shots where it says things like "Welcome to Arkansas" on the side of the highway. And so we just get little quick images of a lot of places, but then they do kind of settle down in places. So Texarkana is one of the places that we see the South. In the chapter, one of the things that I'm really interested in is when Burt Reynolds was starting out and he did White Lightning, which is a great piece of exploitation filmmaking. It was filmed on location in Arkansas. And so it's a look that you might not see otherwise. And then when he directed its follow-up, Gator, 6-7 years later, that was filmed around Savannah, Georgia. And so that, again, has a very particular look. And both of those movies give a very large credit to the governors of the states for helping them film there. They got tax breaks, essentially. But the movie I'm most interested in terms of bringing a different vision of the South is Sharkey's Machine, which is a cop movie that Burt Reynolds directed, and it's set in Atlanta. And Atlanta, I think, is really probably the most important city in the U.S. in the 1970s. It's growing. It had the funny motto, "The city too busy to hate." And that's the world headquarters of Coke, and Hartsfield becomes a regional hub airport. It's got some significant architecture, and that's one of the things that shows up in Sharkey's Machine, is that John Portman, who's Bonaventure Hotel in Los Angeles, is kind of the centerpiece of Frederick Jameson's postmodernism. He also has a hotel in Atlanta, and it's kind of a showpiece, you know, major architectural landmark in a city, which, you know, kind of gives the city kind of a world standing. And Burt Reynolds, as the director, kind of keeps returning to that. It's this big, important landmark building. But then he does the thing which I found most interesting, and it's really where the chapter started for me, is that he shows that in the South, there is a season called winter, which if you watch movies, you would not know that winter happens in the South. You would think that it's just summer all the time. But it does snow in Nashville. We had the one time I was visiting before I went to Vanderbilt, and it snowed 8 inches in a couple of hours. The city was shut down, but it snows there. And so I think that's one of the ways that a movie can kind of open up people's understanding of a location in a way that is kind of cool. So I think he just ranges across the South, but he does kind of set down every once in a while. So there's Atlanta. He has another exploitation movie called WW and the Dixie Dance Kings. That's in Nashville. You know, he's in the kind of northeastern corner of Georgia in Deliverance. And then he got a little lazy and he made a lot of movies in like West Palm Beach, Jupiter, Florida, because that's where he lived.
Right.
And I think he didn't want a long commute later in his stardom.
Yeah, he did have a, you know, obviously Florida was very big in his life, both mm-hmm. in his college. I played football, I think, in Florida.
At FSU.
Right. So, yeah, I lived in Birmingham for about 3.5 years, not that long ago. And I remember, you know, that was one of the things, it was my first introduction to the South as well. It's the same way with your, I know Vanderbilt doesn't, some people didn't believe that that was the true South. And I was, of course, much farther South than you were. But there's no question that Birmingham, I think, of course, Birmingham's a big city, so that makes it a little different as well. But I was surprised about a lot of things living there for the years I did. In fact, we sort of miss Birmingham. But I remember we were there when the infamous snowpocalypse threw that area, including Georgia, Atlanta. In fact, Atlanta got a lot of publicity about it. It was the winter of 2013-14. And they shut down and people were stuck on the roads and stuff. But we were going through the same thing in Alabama, in Birmingham, where the amount of snow, and of course, that's when the jokes always start, is, you folks don't know how to drive. I says, well, how often do we get snow, and what kind of equipment do you think we have? So it's always one of those things that you can see how the South could be misunderstood by some folks. So,
yeah, and the other thing, when you say Birmingham is a big city, it's something that Hollywood movies tend to imagine the U.S. South as kind of small towns mm-hmm. and plantations, and a lot of that is because it's pushed into the past. A city shows up in a Hollywood movie set in the past, and it's like Atlanta getting burned down and gone with the wind. And I think Nashville, the things that I miss about Nashville are actually things that still aren't associated with it in cinema. You go down Nolan's Hill Pike, and it's just full of immigrant and refugee communities, and it's just absolutely wonderful. There's a place called Las Americas where you can get pupusas, and that was the standard Saturday going out, is you go down to get pupusas. And I don't think anybody kind of just inherently associates Central American immigrants with the U.S. South, but they're certainly there, and I think they're a thing that makes it even more interesting now as they're getting more and more diverse as cities.
Yeah, we saw that in Birmingham too, because we had one of the big things in Birmingham was they're very big in, you know, their healthcare industry, both the hospitals and the teaching. And so there were huge amounts of immigrants in Birmingham. And so, as you just point out, the same thing, you could find, it's unbelievable how much different types of food you could find because of the various immigrant communities that were in the area. And as you've pointed out, people don't think about that all the time unless they're actually living in those areas. So I could see where the Burt Reynolds films could have been very useful for giving a different view and a more interesting view, especially as the areas were starting to grow.
Yeah, I mean, they don't make a huge change, but I do think that they do something positive, and that they actually say, well, actual people live here. And they live here now. And it's not a place, and the past isn't past, but I think people are trying to kind of get on with the contemporary moment in Burt Reynolds movies.
So one of your other chapters talks about suburbia, specifically chapter 3, getting around the suburbs and the blockbuster era's big hits. So obviously, in this case, we're looking at the big one, you know, in that era where suddenly, you know, we were getting films that were meant to make tons of money and be real big and boisterous, and they tended to take place in the suburbs. And you give a number of examples of that. And so what did you see as far as were filmmakers trying to, you know, did it become the norm that they wanted to have suburban stories where it was supposed to be the average suburban person going through these, you know, whatever things were going on in the movie?
Well, as I say in the chapter, the thing that is kind of rough or puts up a significant hurdle, if you want to set a movie in the suburbs, is that the suburbs are kind of in the American imaginary, I think, associated with being boring and kind of comfort. And that's kind of poison to a narrative. You need conflict. But I think some of the movies that I write about were kind of accidental hits. So something like The Bad News Bears, I think it's a fascinating document of the 70s and kind of what suburbanization means to Southern California. But I think it is that you want to try to appeal to as broad an audience as possible when you're making these kind of mass entertainment. A lot of these are kind of summer pictures. And so, you know, by the 1980s, the majority of people in the United States live in suburbs. And so I guess you can't help but put them in the suburbs. And I actually think that on the one hand, you got the mid-70s of The Bad News Bears, and then you go into the mid-90s with Wayne's World. And I think those are the ones that are a little weird in interesting ways, and that there's a really strong class politics in Bad News Bears, these are the working class and maybe even the kind of working poor who are kind of against the Yankees, of course, of the kind of solidly middle class suburbanites. And they're always kind of a step behind or a step outside of all the promises that suburbia seem to offer. And then Wayne's World, to my eyes, kind of inverts everything, that the suburbs are a place of fun and excitement, and the city is a place of crunching conformity, which I think is really kind of fascinating, especially since my brother-in-law is from Aurora, Illinois, and I don't recognize the Aurora in Wayne's World from at least where Dave is from. So I think it's in the end, you know, as a person who grew up in the suburbs, I wish I would actually see a place that looks like the suburbs I grew up in. I don't think that's happened yet, but I think that there's all these weird attempts to kind of try and set any kind of version of standard kind of generic entertainments in the suburbs just to see what works.
I can think of, there's two of the films that you talk about that I remember when I saw them, and they do, it's another view of the suburbs, and thinking of E.T. and then Poltergeist, both of which came out the same year and clearly were being filmed about the same time. And they almost look like they took place in the exact same areas, because you see certain, you know, the streets with the cul-de-sacs and the turnarounds, and you just see them all over the place, and it just becomes a normal. In those cases, I would think those are examples of suburbs where everything's supposed to be safe. And then suddenly something happens that completely changes everything, and suddenly it's not so safe anymore. And so you've got a couple other examples of that too. And Amityville Horror is another one where everything's supposed to be normal, and suddenly it doesn't become normal anymore.
Yeah, and especially in Amityville, I think Amityville is a little different because it seems like they have kind of succeeded, and the safety is in real estate. So they should be safe as houses. And that kind of that investment that they have made turns out not to be good.
Same way with Poltergeist.
Yeah, and I think what's really important is that in all of these, like literally there's a cornfield in the backyard of Elliot's house. I mean, they're at the very, very edge of suburban development. Same thing. They're still knocking over burial sites in Poltergeist. And so, and I would say the same thing is actually happening in the Bad News Bears. Like, we're always on the exurban, you know, the very furthest extent of the suburbs. And that, it seems like, well, if we can just get a little further away from the city, then everything will be fine. And there is that kind of false opposition between city and suburb. They need each other. They're symbiotic. And so we just keep pushing further and further and further out. And it never solves the problem.
You also talk in another chapter about cities. you're talking about medium-sized cities. And in this case, we're talking about cities that are sort of in between what we, you know, some of these other examples. But the one I can think of off the, you know, they talk about quite a bit is Pittsburgh, which is an interesting city for people who don't know much about it as far as how it has become particularly interesting as a city, both real, but then also in film, where it has become not only a place that movies are made, but then also has become a setting for films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that chapter actually started, there was, strangely enough, for an English department group of graduate students, there was a big Super Bowl party one year, and I remember a graphic that showed there were more steel workers in Seattle than there were in Pittsburgh. And that there were more tech workers in Pittsburgh than there were in Seattle. And some of that is just a trick of where boundaries are drawn, obviously. But that the identity that Pittsburgh has is of a steel town. And that's just not the case anymore. And that the identity that Seattle now has is that it's a tech town. And that's certainly true, but there's more happening there. And so I grew up outside of Chicago, and one of the great things is that when a band I liked would go on tour, I knew that they would come to Chicago. Then I moved to Christchurch, and no one comes to Christchurch because it's too far. But growing up outside the second city, or maybe the third city now, those cities are allowed to have a lot going on, and we have the kind of imaginative space in our head for that. But these medium-sized cities, that people know about them, but they know one thing about them, and that's enough. And I think that kind of traps cities. I kind of go into things like city branding and other kind of slightly gross things, but I think it makes the chapter more interesting in that cities usually end up thinking about how can we show that there's more. And I think that's an interesting problem for films to deal with, that you can show things like, you know, personal growth and kind of a reimagination of the possible if you go to these medium-sized cities, because while there's a sense of kind of being trapped in one identity, there's also the potential to escape that identity.
And Pittsburgh is an interesting city, and it's a thriving city, which, given where it is in the country, you know, in the north, mm-hmm. As you point out, it was a steel town, and yet it is a different place now, but still doing well. And I consider it to be sort of in the same way as Atlanta, or a city that reinvented itself and has changed because of it in a positive way.
Yeah. I mean, there was a history professor at Vanderbilt, Professor Dickerson, who talked about how his family would only do laundry on Sundays because that was the day that your drawers wouldn't turn gray because all the dust would settle on it. That's certainly not the case now. You can put your laundry out any day in Pittsburgh because it has actually become a post-industrial economy.
So quickly, I wanted to make sure we talk briefly about the last chapter in the book where you talk about scenes outside of America. And you particularly choose to take advantage of Disney films in this chapter. What were some of the things you saw as far as an American company, an American, you know, when you talk about America, Disney is pretty high on the things that people would think about. And yet they were, you know, they were using non-US locations for many of their live action films.
Well, I think kind of the easiest entry point into that is that you can see the workings of ideology. That people conceive of Disney, I think rightly so, as kind of super duper American. So much so that I went and saw, this is a weird thing about living in Brisbane, we were the first city outside of Europe to get the opera about Walt Disney that Philip Glass wrote. And that one is very much, that's based on a German novel, and it was put on in London and Madrid. So it's kind of completely outside of the U.S. orbit, and yet it's about the kind of foundational myth of the creation of an American identity. And then I think what's really interesting is most people, when they write about Disney, they write about the parks and they write about the animated movies. And so I wanted to say, look at all these live action movies. Why does no one talk about them? The simple answer is that they're not very good. But I think in their disposability makes them really interesting, because kind of get them out there, get the people to see them, and they're basically, they're the programming for, you know, the wonderful world of Disney, so that for 4 weeks you get these live action movies that are just like, you know, passable entertainment, and then you get that special animated feature. And so they kind of exist as a fascinating contrast to the stuff that we're most used to. And so a lot of them are still just filmed on studio sets or in California, standing in as other places. But by kind of imaginatively going to these places, and by giving us kind of really poor versions of other people's cultures, they create a chance for the American ideology that we understand as being Disney-fied. It gives that ideology something to kind of push against and triumph over. And this one actually comes out of, the chapter came out of watching In Search of the Castaways, and it's kind of in its treatment of Maori. And, you know, living in New Zealand, New Zealand culture is Maori culture. And that's kind of maybe not understood as well when you don't live there. And so kind of looking into things like, what were the tourism numbers before the 90s, before Rajanomics kind of brought in neoliberal economics to New Zealand. And that's just, people just didn't know anything about New Zealand. And so that's what originally said to me, well, I need to look at all these other movies and see how they deal with similarly, you know, in scare quotes, foreign cultures. And it's pretty consistent, pretty predictable. But I think it's a pretty consistent way that even in these disposable pictures, that there's a really coherent way of dealing with others. And it shows them that they're like, you know, maybe 40% pretty good, but they just don't have what the American ideology has. So they must be swept aside.
Yeah, the films you talk about with the Disney films, as you pointed out, I mean, it's mostly in the 60s. And it was right around the time that Disney was, because it was very big into television, and they had to fill time, as you point out, and it was easier for them to just reshow films in pieces than create entirely new content. So a lot of these films just happened to be made or were being made at the same time. So it became, but they needed to be a little bit more exotic. They needed to make it something more interesting in order to try to stay with the Disney brand. So you show what they consider to be other parts of the world.
Yeah, and then there's those, and those are the ones I focus on. And then there's also kind of like the trained animal pictures and kind of kid movies. And so that's where Kurt Russell got his start. And you get things like The Ugly Dachshund and The Million Dollar Duck. And there were moments when I was watching some of these movies, especially Monkeys Go Home, where you reach this point where you find yourself saying, is this movie actually misunderstood, and is it really genius? And it is not. But I think in watching them over and over and over again, you can see that there's actually a really coherent worldview that kind of appears throughout them, which I think is a testament to, even though they're just kind of cranking out content, the brand is strong.
Of course, they're also, a lot of these, the reason why I think we hear about these, or people think of these films, especially depending on your age, is that the baby boomers probably see these with a large amount of nostalgia, because that's what they were seeing when they were kids. And these kind of movies, and I can remember, I mean, I grew up in the 60s and early 70s, I was born in 56, so I was in this era, and it's Disney was what you were just used to. It was part of the regular, not only in the movie theaters, but on TV. And so a lot of these examples are things where we think of, as you say, you think to yourself, okay, is it nostalgia I'm thinking of, or were these really good? And the answer, as you point out in many cases, was no, it was nostalgia only because they weren't very good.
I mean, there are moments. I do love a trained animal picture. And so I do, especially ones with cats. I mean, that's a lot of hard work. And so, no, but otherwise, no. I mean, I love Fred McMurray, but there's not much he can do with the script in Bon Voyage.
Yeah, I think I'd have to go back at some point and watch The Love Bug, because that was a movie I remember fondly, but I haven't seen it in a long, long time, and I can only imagine what would happen if I actually watched it.
Save up a couple hours and it will be an experience. I watched that 3 times and then discarded everything I had to say about it. Yeah, well.
So obviously you put together a collection. Do you feel like this modern cinema, have things changed because of CGI and other digital form ways of making films? Or are we still seeing plenty of movie making where the geography can still be an important aspect of the whole thing?
Well, one of the reasons I put the cutout date at 2000 is that I didn't want to have to kind of tackle digital cinema. But I think there's kind of, for all the possibilities that CGI offers, I think there is just something, and the movie that I kind of always turn to is The Fast and the Furious. I remember when we played that at the movie theater I worked at, and people were just eating that up with a spoon, because there's something really incredible and exciting about seeing something that you know actually happened and is really there. And so guys driving cars real fast, you know, and almost crashing into each other is thrilling. And I think like actual locations that are not kind of digitized to within an inch of their life still have a lot of appeal. And they do kind of, they make their return frequently throughout kind of release schedule throughout the year. And I do think that, you know, using digital tools for storytelling is, you know, I'm all behind that. You can even, you know, you can do things, you can change the color of a place and, so it looks like Alabama, but there's something a little funny about it. So like the Coen brothers, when they made A Brother Where Art Thou, or even Inside Llewyn Davis, like just by kind of changing the colors, you can, you know, you can change time and it makes it a little bit kind of unfamiliar. So I don't think that the importance of geography has disappeared at all. And I think when you notice it, when the movie comes out and you're like, oh, wow, this is something I've not seen. This is a new vision of a place I thought I knew. It can be quite exciting. And just yesterday, I was walking around the city of Vienna. They're showing a rehabbed print of Der Golem with live music accompaniment. So I was going to go buy a ticket. And there is a stable right in the middle of the city here. And there actually was a Disney live action movie, the title of it escapes me now, about horses in Vienna. And so there is still this kind of inside the city, you could just do a simple tracking shot and all of a sudden we're in a stable. And it's moments like that. They don't have to be the big sweeping helicopter, although now it's usually a drone shot that establishes a huge landscape, but it can just be a little moment in a transition between scenes or the background in a dialogue that kind of gives us a different window into a particular location.
It's funny. Of course, you haven't been in the United States living for a while, but it has become the norm that every single car dealership in the United States ends their commercials with a drone shot showing their dealership. You know, and you can tell because they all are exactly the same. The drone goes straight up. And it's funny how suddenly that drones have become ubiquitous with everything as far as visuals are concerned.
I should say, in working with engineers, I shouldn't say drone. I should say unmanned aerial vehicle. Drone has too many negative associations, and you might not win a grant if you say drone. So one of the big things in Australia, actually, is they use UAVs for agricultural uses. So drones aren't all bad. They kept on telling me that when they were you working with me.
So, obviously, then this book, you've spent a large amount of time compiling this. Are you? Do you have other plans to do anything more related with geography, or are you going off in a different direction, or where are you going forward?
Well, I think geography is kind of in the kind of larger rubric of an interest in space and kind of creations of space. So I have kind of a big kind of too big for one book project that's got two or three parts, which is about infrastructure and to a degree logistics and genre films. So like I was talking about earlier, there's an article I wrote called Infrastructure After the Zombie Apocalypse. And so I'm interested in the imagination of infrastructure in post-apocalyptic and dystopian movies and literature. Because I'm interested in how we can imagine what the world will look like after it's done with us, more or less. So this lets me be really literal-minded again about movies. In a way that then opens them up to kind of show how the background of where they take place can get pushed to the foreground. So a movie like The Road, it does make sense that the road is still there because nothing grows. Because if plants could grow, the road as the highway that he's walking along, it would no longer be there. And we can just look at Detroit. There's urban prairies in Detroit because you get a couple of seeds and they get in a crack in the pavement, and before you know it, it's completely split open. And so kind of using that very literal-minded, almost gotcha approach, I think it can give me some access into thinking about what happens after this version of our civilization fails, and how can we kind of come to terms with fixing those failures. I started thinking about this most clearly when I was watching The Postman, which I think it's a bum rap. I don't know if it's supposed to be funny, but I quite enjoy it. And there's actually in the background of a lot of shots, just windmills. And they actually have electricity because it's running on wind power. And so it's just this little bit of set design and set dressing that opens up parts of the film that, you know, I think are much more interesting than actually just the narrative.
Well, I think infrastructure as a top, you know, I think it sounds to me like you've hit on a good overall topic of wherever, because I think infrastructure is such an interesting concept and things that think, you know, the whole idea of looking at infrastructure, and we all are used to now hearing about infrastructure mostly for the negative reasons. But so I could see where this could be an interesting way to continue on with your film study.
Yeah, I think the reason we only hear about infrastructure in a negative sense is because the only time you actually register it is when it fails. And the point of infrastructure, and a lot of people writing about infrastructural studies write this, the point is that it's invisible and that you just take it for granted. And so after the earthquakes in Christchurch, we didn't have plumbing for 6 months. And the City Solution, which that was actually kind of awesome, they just put portaloos at the bottom of your driveway. And so I would get up in the morning and you just see people walking down the end of their driveway to use the portaloo. And then when we actually got, you know, indoor plumbing back in the house, it was so exciting. And so I think it's when you combine that kind of sensibility with kind of generic forms, and usually, you know, film studies people find generic forms interesting when there are these moments that escape convention. I think those two put in combination can be really quite fascinating.
Well, good luck with that. It sounds interesting all by itself, even on top of what you've already done. So hopefully if when you get it to a point where it's published, which who knows when that'll be, obviously. I mean, the research phase is always the most interesting, but also the most tricky part of any kind of project like this.
Yeah, I mean, I just have a pile of notes now, and eventually I'll actually think of something to say about them.
Right. So hopefully maybe someday we can talk about that. But other than that, I really appreciate the amount of time you gave me today. I mean, I think the book is fascinating to me because of it just happens to be things that interest me as well. And many of the films you choose, because of the time period you chose, they were right in my, you know, period of real understanding. So I hope people reach out for the book, Imaginary Geography of Hollywood Cinema, 1960 to 2000 by Christian B. Long. So I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today, and I hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
My great thanks to Christian. I hope his book gives you a new way to examine films. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network.